Forget those five stupid words. You want to know Janet Yellen's favorite number? You do, right? Okay, here it is, 242,000. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Friday today, the 4th of March. Glad as always to have you with us, everybody. Context being everything, that 242,000 figure is denominated in jobs added to the economy last month, so the Bureau of Labor Statistics told us this morning, at the same time that they told us the unemployment rate held steady at 4.9%. That'll be the point of departure today for our weekly wrap of Wall Street and Beyond. For that, we've got Lee Gallagher. She's at Fortune Magazine. Catherine Rampell is at the Washington Post. They are actually both physically in our New York bureau. Hey, everybody.
Hi, Kai.
All right, so Lee, let me start with you and get the gut check on the jobs number. Obviously, it's good. I wonder how good it is. Can we now stop worrying about jobs all the time?
Not really.
No.
I mean, the headline is good. That number is great. That it's holding steady is great.
Yeah.
Wages ticked down a little bit,
yep.
And the work week fell.
Yeah.
So these are not good things.
Wait, so on the work week fell. We're working fewer hours.
Fewer hours, it means less money in everyone's pockets. And that's, you know, we know we're still struggling, but things should be inching ever so slightly in the other direction.
Catherine, give me the wages analysis here, right? I mean, it was, you know, 3 cents or something, not huge, but definitely the wrong way in this economy.
The wrong way. Year over year, we're still up something like 2%, I think, in hourly wages.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So it's better than a poke in the eye with a sharp stick. you know, that's better than nothing. I agree. At this point in the recovery, given how much job growth we've seen the longest streak in job growth, I think, in terms of months,
yeah.
I think on record.
Like ever, yeah.
Given where we are, it feels like wages should be rising more.
So, Lee,
but
why? That's the
big – you solve that and you solve all the problems in the world. I mean, you really do. You really do. It's like Mark Cuban says, growth cures all. I mean, everything goes away if our economy is only growing a little bit more, a lot more. So why? Well, this is it's such a slow recovery. And, you know, don't forget that the whole economy is still suffering from oil prices being so low. So it's, you know, that's a factor.
Catherine, does wages have anything to do with the kinds of jobs? I mean, we keep hearing that the kinds of jobs we're getting, retail and fast food and all that jazz, they're just not doing it. That's the big part of the problem.
That could be part of the problem, the composition of jobs. But if you look at another index,
mm-hmm.
I think it's the ECI, the Employer Cost
Employment
Index.
Employment Cost Index, yeah.
Employment Cost Index, thank you. That, as I understand it, is supposed to be weighted for those compositional changes, and it also isn't showing much improvement. So it's a puzzle. I mean, if you talk to employers or if you look at employer survey data, they are complaining about not being able to find enough workers,
right?
They say that they just can't find skilled talent. They can't find available talent. The unemployment rate is low. Those things should add up to employers bidding up wages for this supposed shortage of workers, and it's not happening.
All right. New topic. I don't want five words on this, but I do want very quickly to acknowledge what this might mean for Janet Yellen and the Fed and the next possibility of a rate hike. And I do mean quickly because it's not worth a whole lot more time than that. Lee?
I think she stays the course. Six words. How's that?
That was good. That was good. Catherine, you want to weigh in there quickly?
I think I'm on the same page.
Okay,
they're still waiting and seeing.
you're a fast word counter, Lee Gallagher. All right, very quickly because we got to go. The trade gap we learned this morning widened last month. Give me that just in terms of what it means for us and the global economy, Catherine. Because we've talked before about how we're doing all right, and the rest of the globe maybe not so much.
Well, if you look at the numbers, both imports and exports have been trending downward, which suggests that just trade in general is not as active as it once was because there are so many other countries that are suffering right now. You know, the United States, I think, is a little bit in trouble in terms of trade just because so many other countries are having such problems that their currencies are falling in value,
right?
So that makes our exports a little bit less competitive if our currency is more expensive.
Right.
So that probably won't help in the near future either.
The trade gap, as always, a dollar story. Catherine Rampell at The Washington Post and Lee Gallagher at Fortune Magazine. Thanks a lot, you two.
Thanks, Kai.
All right, have a good weekend. On Wall Street today, it was fine, thanks. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. A bit more here about the jobs report, because really 4 minutes on that is not enough. One of the really nice data points in that thing was the rise in something called the labor force participation rate, up 0.2% in February to the highest level in more than a year. Fine. Great. But what's important here is the labor force participation, basically a measure of how much adult America is actively engaged in the workforce, has been falling and then falling some more since the Great Recession. And now the last 3 months, maybe, it looks like it is finally turning around. From our desk up at Oregon Public Broadcasting, Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman explains why that matters.
Labor force participation rate sounds complicated, although actually it's pretty simple. It's the share of American adults actively engaged in the workforce, either in a job or looking for one, as opposed to
on the sidelines, sitting at home in front of their TV.
Labor analyst Andrew Statner at the Century Foundation says, to be fair, they could also be in school or retired. But he says the main problem has been the millions of people in their prime years who could be working but haven't even been trying.
It means that the job market is not providing enough jobs and enough good jobs. And I think we're starting to see that turn a corner.
Since November, 1.5 million Americans have come back into the workforce. Economist Carl Tannenbaum at Northern Trust says it's a sign of something we haven't seen in a long time, optimism.
Those who have been discouraged are being tempted to come back into the labor force. In addition, we've been seeing a lot of existing workers quit their jobs for better ones. And so that leaves openings at the entry levels, which are attractive to those who may have been sitting it out.
Economists think all those folks sitting it out are one reason wages have stayed so low. Their presence on the sidelines pushes job candidates to take whatever wages employers offer. But now, with labor force participation rising again, employers might have to sweeten the pot if they want to get the workers they need. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
At the Republican debate last night, there was a heated discussion between Ted Cruz and Donald Trump about immigration. Listen to this.
His record right now is one of repeatedly hiring illegal aliens
and
using American workers.
Go ahead, Mr. Trump.
First of all, I've had tens of thousands of people working for me, most of which, almost 98% of the people in this country from this country. I'm very proud of it.
Obviously, that was drastically abridged, but this wasn't the first time that Mr. Trump has been attacked over his use of a specific kind of seasonal worker at one of his Florida resorts. Marketplace's Bree Benishore reports that this type of worker, it's known as an H-2B visa, is a major pillar of the guest worker program in this country.
Last night, Trump briefly tried to explain why he and many other hotel owners rely on guest workers.
People don't want a short-term job. So we will bring people in and we will send the people out.
That process is known as the H-2B visa program. It's specifically for jobs that last a few months. They're almost always seasonal.
Restaurants, hotels and motels, summer camps, seafood workers.
Edward Alden is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. One criticism of the program brought up in the debate by Marco Rubio is that it displaces U.S. workers.
There is no real objective substantive study on a national scale which will tell you that there is a huge displacement of U.S. workers by the H-2B workers.
Muzaffar Chishti is with the Migration Policy Institute. He says Americans in Dallas aren't likely to travel to Vermont for a three-month ski lift job. But while employers are required to try to hire Americans first and pay prevailing wages, in reality, it's not clear that they do.
Employers of H-2B workers are paying them, in fact, about 25% less than the average wage for U.S. workers in those industries.
Jennifer Gordon is a professor at Fordham Law School. She cited an Economic Policy Institute study. Gordon says workers, once they are brought in, are bound to their employer and can't go to another, even if they're mistreated. At the end of the last year, the size of the H-2B guest worker program was effectively doubled by Congress. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
The political stalemate in Spain continues. Today, for the second time since December, Parliament failed to form a government there. There is, though, some promising economic news. Spain took a battering during the European debt crisis, as you might remember. But new figures today showed home foreclosures are dropping. And a week ago, GDP growth, gross domestic product growth, topped expectations. However, the unemployment rate is stuck above 20%, with young people and those in southern Spain among the worst hit. The BBC's Liana Josea filed this report from the southern city of Seville.
Andalusia's capital, Seville, is one of Spain's most beautiful cities. Its cobbled streets lead you through elegant plazas. But away from its historic center, here in the southern suburb of La Eminencia, the buildings are low-rise, cheap brick structures. And it's here the Monet's Foundation Social Center run training courses to try and get young unemployed Spaniards into work. Victor Jimenez is a tall, thin, 25-year-old father of one who has been unemployed for over 2 years.
The last job I had was repairing computers. The company needed to save money, so they sacked 21 people, and one of them was me.
Youth unemployment is still at 46%, and so, like many Spaniards in their 20s and 30s, Victor and his wife can't afford their own home and must live with their parents.
I feel, what can I say, impotent. I'd like to be able to tell my son that his parents have been working to earn the house that we live in.
The center runs vocational training, like making frilled flamenco dresses, where I met 28-year-old Wiam Achab.
I understand that you have a job, so what are you doing here?
Because it's just a temporary job. I'm covering someone on maternity leave.
Tell me your dream job.
Wow, the job of my dreams. I'd really like to work as a receptionist in a hotel because I speak Arabic, French and Spanish.
It's a modest dream for this young woman who is one of Spain's many temporary workers.
This year has been a great year for older people, not for young people.
Economist Ignacio Garcia.
I mean, for young people, we have created some jobs, but they are basically temporary jobs, low-qualified jobs. They could be considered a lost generation.
But might it be good for employers that they can hire and fire very easily? The labor market is more flexible.
Having temporary workers means that these workers are less productive because they have less incentives. They have no learning within the firm. So this is also very problematic in terms of productivity for the economy as a whole.
In a difficult labor market, some young Spaniards are creating their own jobs in one of the country's growth sectors, tourism. Loralee Mullier has spent most of her life in Seville. After losing her job in marketing and exports, she now works in a new company, not just a tourist.com. Set up and run by young people, it uses social media to advertise its tailored tours in flamenco dancing and tapas, traditional Spanish snacks.
Are you earning a lot less than you were before?
Yes. 40% less.
So last year in Spain, you had this record drop in unemployment. Do people here in southern Spain feel it?
No. We hear it on the news, but we still don't feel the difference.
Economists say a new government will have to implement deeper labour reforms to create better long-term jobs. Till then, young Spaniards will have to wait and hope that political instability or further economic crisis doesn't wipe out what small gains they've made.
The BBC's Liana Josea in Seville, Spain for us. Coming up.
I remember holding her hand and saying, "Nice to meet you. I'm sorry I meet you here. Can you tell me in your own words what happened?"
Healthcare workers spotting and helping victims of human trafficking. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials up 62 points today, 0.3%, closed at 17,006. The NASDAQ up 9 points, 0.2%, 47.17. The S&P 500 increased 6 points, 0.3%, ended at 1,999.99 Why did we take it out that far? Because we could, that's why. For the week, the Dow up 2.2%. The NASDAQ gained 2.8%. The S&P 500 jumped 2.7%. H&R Block missed earnings expectations. Part of the blame, it says, the increasing number of procrastinators waiting to file their taxes. H&R Block refunded more than 15.5% today. Intuit, which owns TurboTax, charged up 1.5%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 1.87%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. You remember how a couple of days ago I said that this is a global economy, we only live in it, and then I launched into some story about China? Well, from the Marketplace desk of what goes around comes around, this item today. The theater chain AMC, owned by the Chinese firm Dalian Wanda, is going to buy another chain, Carmike Cinemas, for more than $1 billion. It's going to make AMC the biggest movie theater operator in the United States, and as such, assuming it passes antitrust review, could give AMC quite the leg up in negotiations with studios, because they split ticket sales with theater chains according to a complex, if not Byzantine, formula. Marketplace's Annie Baxter has more on that one.
AMC is currently the number two movie theater chain in the country with its 5,400 movie screens. Now it wants to fold Carmike's roughly 3,000 screens into its business. Here's Piper Jaffray analyst Stan Myers.
Combined, they may have 25% market share of the business.
And the deal will allow them to wring out as much as $35 million in annual cost savings. That comes through consolidating management teams and back office operations. And Meyer says the combined company can potentially reduce costs with, say, concessions vendors, getting an even better price on the stuff they then sell to captive theatergoers at a huge markup.
That's popcorn, candy, drinks, and now, more recently, alcohol.
But the bigger leverage might come with film studios, which charge steep film rental rates, eating up more than half of box office receipts. Meyer says a combined AMC Carmike could have an easier time repelling rate hikes from studios like Disney.
You see them coming to the negotiation table and asking a much higher rate.
Columbia University professor Ira Deutschman says the combined chain could also use its size to get preferential treatment from studios to run a big movie like Star Wars.
One of the secrets of the business that most people don't understand is that they do not allow theaters that are nearby to book the same films.
That will make it harder for smaller chains, and Deutschman says independent filmmakers and distributors could also have a tougher time getting their films shown at a massive chain. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
We've been talking this week about how the healthcare industry is taking some first steps toward tackling a problem that up until pretty much recently has been the responsibility of law enforcement. Human trafficking, people being held against their will and forced to work for somebody else, frequently in the sex trade. Turns out that healthcare professionals are really well placed to spot this. Best guesses are that nearly 9 out of every 10 sex trafficking victims winds up in an emergency room or a doctor's office while they are being held. It can be tough, though, to identify victims, and even tougher to help them once you've done that. From our help desk at WHYY, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein wraps up his series.
There are 5,686 hospitals in the United States. 60 of them have a plan in place if someone who's being trafficked walks through the door. The Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston is one of them. A few months back, nurse Nina Ribeiro thought her shift in the emergency department was winding down.
I had just taken a patient up to the ICU. There was my lady screaming and, you know, it was a typical emergency department night.
Then a young woman, Deborah, not her real name, walked in with her mother, wanting to detox from heroin and saying she'd been raped.
She was Caucasian, well-dressed, clean, blonde. I remember thinking to myself, oh my goodness, what a quote-unquote normal family. Her mom was sitting over here to the right, and I said, hi, nice to meet you. You must be her mom. I'm sorry we meet under these circumstances. And as soon as I said that, I remember very clearly her mom crying, her mom having tears in her eyes.
Immediately, Ribeiro sensed something didn't line up. She'd treated plenty of well-heeled young women who'd been raped, but few who also were involved with heroin. The Brigham's trafficking protocols ask staff to tune in to red flags, any intuition, aware that anyone can be trafficked. In her one-hour trafficking training, Ribeiro had been told to ask open-ended questions to help build rapport.
I remember holding her hand and saying, nice to meet you, I'm sorry I meet you here. Can you tell me in your own words what happened?
Deborah told her a few weeks back she'd started hanging out with a couple. Then the man took her to a hotel. Deborah told Ribeiro she was made to have sex. Deborah said she had sex with 200 men, compensated in heroin.
This young, beautiful girl who could have been anyone's daughter was truly forced to sell her body to more men than you can ever gauge. Then finally, the tears came out, and I just remember having tears in my eyes and thinking, my dear God, does this really happen in this area?
Ribeiro brought Deborah a stockpile, Plan B pills, prevention for STDs, and Ativan for withdrawal.
I gave her a hug, and I told her, you know, I'm very sorry that this happened to you.
She checked Deborah in for the night and told her the next morning she'd see Dr. Hani Stoklosa, one of the nation's leading experts on healthcare and trafficking.
She had been in the emergency department at that point for well over 12 hours.
Stoklosa told Deborah staff psychiatrists had spent the morning looking to land Deborah in a program for substance abuse and counseling. As the day stretched on, the Brigham staff kept striking out. No one had any room. Then Stoklosa heard Deborah had eloped, the term they use for when someone walks out the door.
There's no world where that should be the case. She still has her drug addiction, and she's going to need to get those drugs somehow.
Even though the hospital had failed to help Deborah, this still qualifies as a success story. The reality is that today, human trafficking victims with stories a lot like Deborah's walk in and out of ERs around the country completely undetected. One study found just 5% of ER workers have ever been trained to deal with these patients. 73% of ER docs and nurses don't even think their patients are affected by trafficking. Stoklosa says today, most services for victims are short-term and poorly funded. It makes it hard for doctors and nurses to interrupt the cycles of violence and exploitation.
If a victim of trafficking identifies, hey, I want to get out of this situation, I want to get sober, I want to leave my pimp, what do we have to offer? And the short answer is very, very little. We're in this position where if we uncover that trafficking is going on, we need to have those resources in place that will match what they've been getting from their trafficker in a way.
Stoklosa says trafficking meets critical basic needs like food and shelter and, as dysfunctional as it may be, a kind of emotional connection, at least for some people. She worries asking patients to relive these traumatic episodes without a social service fix puts these victims back in danger.
On one hand, it's critical that we identify victims of trafficking because there are very few opportunities they'll have to get out of that situation. On the other hand, if we don't have the resources there, then we burn that bridge.
That's one reason so few hospitals are investing in doing this work. It makes little sense to identify human trafficking victims if it leads to little more than people sharing their heart-wrenching stories. Plus, no one can say for sure if it's 1 in 100 patients being trafficked, 1 in 1,000, or 1 in 10,000. And yet, a handful of hospitals and doctors in Hawaii, New York, Texas, and Massachusetts have stepped up, opening free clinics for victims of trafficking.
I think all of us in the healthcare arena would say this is a reasonable kind of charitable contribution back to the communities in which we live.
That's Ann Prestipino, an executive at Massachusetts General Hospital, who supports the hospital's new Freedom Clinic for trafficking victims just across town from the Brigham, where Deborah got her care. Clinics like MGH's run on grants and other soft money, and that leaves them vulnerable. The first trafficking clinic opened in L.A. to only close after funding dried up. Prestipino understands how limited healthcare's response has been so far, how people like Deborah walk out the door. But what's happening slowly, she says, is understanding that Deborah's real, not some urban legend. She remembers when domestic violence was as subterranean as trafficking is today.
They'll hear the stories of the battered wife who finally has the courage to escape. And that's where it has to start. It's creating the awareness that, you know, this kind of problem exists.
What hospitals and doctors are doing, she says, is diagnosing patients as victims of human trafficking. That's new. It's a beginning. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Awareness of human trafficking is growing, as are the resources to help, as Dan has been telling us all week. We put together a list of some of those resources. It's on our webpage, marketplace.org. course, final note on the way out today. You can file it under unintended consequences, I guess. As Apple and the FBI get set for their court date in a couple of weeks, this item from Reuters: court filings in a New York case involving the phone maker and the FBI, that is to say, not the case out in San Bernardino. Those filings by law enforcement groups, it should be said, show that criminals are getting rid of their burner phones and switching to iPhones because of the encryption. Wiretaps of conversations show that criminals are calling Apple's encryption system, quote, another gift from God. There you go. All right, Friday afternoon, we're out of here. The Dow up 62 points, 0.3%. The NASDAQ up 9 points, 0.2%. The S&P 500 increased 6 points, 0.3%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Sitar Nieves, but she's doing some other stuff for a couple of months. Patty Hirsch is filling in the meanwhile. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer around here. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourselves a good weekend, everybody. We'll see you back here on Monday. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.